Well, hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and we are in the middle of what has been a very fun experience for me, Mentor Month, here the month of April. Last week, you got to hear an extensive conversation between myself and Larry Kudlow, who hopefully needed no introduction as a result of his high profile in two different White Houses and two different major cable news networks over the last 40 plus years. The week before that, you heard from Nick Murray, who probably was someone who needed an introduction if you're not in the financial advisory profession. But if you are in the advisory profession, Nick is very well known and, for reasons we talked about a couple weeks ago, an extremely valuable mentor in my life. Next week, we're going to finalize and kind of bring to a apex and conclusion Mentor Month with a special episode featuring excerpts from my late father, Dr. Greg Bahnsen, who died in 1995. But luckily left us thousands of lectures and books and articles and various pieces of intellectual capital from which I was able to extract a lot of his material on the subject of work and tie in the subject of my new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, to some of the ideological legacy of my late dad. But my guest here today is one who is very, very specific to the topic of Capitol Record, my focus on capital markets, my chosen profession in wealth management and in investing capital for a living. And this gentleman, Lowell Miller, became introduced to me in 2007, and unbeknownst to him at the time, began a process that had a total intellectual transformation of the way I thought about investing client capital. And subsequently, I would not only become a devoted dividend growth investor, work with Lowell's firm, Miller Howard Investments, Lowell being one of the namesakes, obviously, of that firm, for many, many years. But eventually, in what was it, 2018, I think it came out in early 2019. My book, The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World, which at the time was the second book I had written, really was a culmination of a lot of things that started with the influence that this gentleman has had on my life and career. So Lowell makes the top four here in Mentor Month and is stuck with the dubious distinction of being one of David Bahnsen's adult professional mentors. And it's a privilege for me to welcome to Capitol Record my longtime friend and mentor, Lowell Miller. Lowell, welcome to Capitol Record.
Hi, good day. It's good to see you.
So, Lowell, I think I'll start us off by, I just kind of gave a little background for everyone about how, why you're here and what the particular category of mentorship was. But maybe you could give the audience a little bit of background, of yourself and your adult professional journey.
Sure. It's a little hard to keep it to the short version, but I think I will, if I could stay focused on investing and not everything else in my life, maybe we can fit it in with the, what is it, 3-4 hours you've allocated here?
You got it. That's right.
Okay. So, when I was younger, I thought I would be a sculptor and a poet, which seems a little maybe out of place for an investment professional. And in my early 20s, I started publishing poetry in Rolling Stone, and they used to pay $30 per poem. And then one day we got a letter from Jan Wenner, who said, well, we have to cut costs here. We're going to pay $25 per poem. At that point, I was actually still in NYU Law School. I wasn't working. I didn't really have wasn't giving too much thought to supporting myself or accumulating wealth or anything like that. So, but I did say to myself, holy mackerel, this is, I got to do something to make some money. And I always had a strong interest in the markets. I always had a strong interest in probabilities. And so I started educating myself. And I'm 100% autodidact. I never went to business school. I never worked at a firm. I just studied. I was a good student, so I studied. And initially, I was interested in technical analysis, which is like where you go if you're interested in the markets, but you don't really know anything. But my kind of artistic and creative capabilities sort of entered into the picture, because there, what you want is pattern recognition. You gain insight and you gain creativity by understanding patterns. And that's really the essence of technical analysis, which is to understand patterns.
Let me interrupt, though. You mentioned something just in passing, but I think it's a kind of interesting thing. Why were you at NYU Law School? You had this interest in the creative and the poetry. You ended up studying patterns and technical analysis and financial markets. Somewhere in there, did you want to practice law?
Never. And especially once I met who my colleagues would be.
Yeah.
But this was basically a way of avoiding the brutal job market of 1970, 71. Mm. And my father was a lawyer and a professor at NYU. And it was convenient for them, for me to say, well, I'll go to law school, because they would pay. It was a privileged background, but they weren't really wealthy, but it was okay. They would love for me to go to law school. So I did. And I found it, honestly, not to toot my horn, I found it not that challenging. So I spent a lot of time in law school reading and writing poetry and exploring the world. And I was nevertheless on Law Review. So it was not really, I didn't really have the intention of being a lawyer, but I did know that once upon a time, it was an integral part of a liberal education to read the law. Mm. I said, well, I'll do that. And I found it, in the end, quite helpful to understand. If you study law, you understand the sort of the broad scope of society and how it's all put together. And you also understand a certain way of analytical thinking and Platonic questioning and discussion of things. So it was good, and it kept me away from the jungle of working for a boss for that period of time. I actually never have had a boss. So this is another way, I guess. I'm not really your typical investment manager.
So you get into looking at technical analysis.
Right.
And you know, you start having some aspiration to realize you're going to need to make some money in your life, but you're not going to get that writing poetry for Rolling Stone, and you're going to finish up school. And where does technical analysis lead you?
Well, I'm like Biden here, not getting the years exactly right, but about 1976 or 1977, I wrote a book called A Momentum Gap Analysis, based on a lot of patterns that I had seen. Sort of a system, it was sort of very highly systematized approach, looking for certain kinds of gaps in market pricing, and on the assumption that gaps reflect a kind of a disconnect between the views of buyers and sellers. So anyhow, I published this book, and I was in my mid to mid late 20s, and I really didn't know anything, but it was named Stock Market Book of the Year. And I thought, well, they don't really know that much, do they? So I can forge ahead here. And so I had this book under my belt, and I wrote some sections of some newsletters of people who contacted me. And I studied the martial art of Aikido, and I have all of my adult life. And one night at a little party at our dojo, I got to talking with this kind of odd bird. It turned out he was a PhD EE from RPI. He was professor of computer science and robotics at New Pulse at the time, and his previous work experience was inertial navigation systems at Sperry and Rockwell. The inertial navigation systems, for in case you probably know what that is, but I'll tell you what it is. It's rocket science. So we got to talking about it, and I said, you know, I've been looking for a quant for a long time because I would like to embed my ideas in software. And he said, oh, well, I tried to crack the market with mathematics for a long time, and I knew I needed some market expertise to work with. So, well, more or less the next day we got started. I gave him a copy of my book, and we started there. And we started exploring everything that I thought I knew about technical analysis and all that I had read, because, as I said, I'm kind of a student. I read everything that everybody had to say, not much of which was worth anything. And indeed, we studied basically everything that everybody had said, and what we found was that, indeed, not much really worked. A little. And what did work was when there would be multiple incidences of different kinds of signals happening at the same time. It's an old principle that IBM used to use for verifying things, and we called it multiple simultaneity. So from there, we started advising. We ran a program every day. It was early days of technology. We had something called a transet, which was basically a kind of a buffer modem that we would set up on a printer in people's offices, and we would send them the results of our daily scan, which took all night, and it would print out in the morning, a little bit like a private teletype. So we started working with the managers and also some pension funds, USF&G, FedEx, people like that, Cigna. And but after a while, I'd go around and, you know, this is my first acquaintance with business. I barely had a suit. But after a while, I would go around and see what they were doing and how they were doing it and honestly how they were getting paid. And I thought, we're on the wrong side of the desk here. So, but I also realized that people saw technical work, no matter how quantitative you made it, people saw technical work as some kind of mysticism, some kind of voodoo, tea leaves. And after a while, I did too, because I was kind of interested in momentum. But what I found was that if you're interested in momentum, almost the minute you get into something, you've got a short-term loss.
Yeah.
Right? So I wanted a more durable, sustainable, long-term approach to investing. And so I would say I took myself back to school.
Well, let's unpack real quick what you said, because I know what you meant, but I don't know that every listener did. When you would go out and you would see with these institutional clients that you were on the wrong side of the desk, you're referring to the revenue model. They were getting paid. Some of these portfolio managers were getting paid basis points for managing gazillions of dollars of assets. How was a technical research firm like yours getting paid at the time?
Well, okay. What we were, you know, to put a little slight dignified gloss on it, we were the timeliness input for their multi-factor value models. And how we were getting paid was primarily in soft dollars. And what that meant was that these managers would trade, whether it was pension fund or private managers, we had a lot of hedge funds, whoever it was, they were doing a lot of trading with brokers. And at that time, commissions were much higher, and they embedded a research cost. If you went to like a Merrill Lynch or a Goldman or something, you pay X commission, and their research would be embedded in it. But you could go independent, you could have pretty much the same commission structure, but the broker would then pay an independent like us instead of Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs paying their own research department.
So you had to run a little trading operation as well?
No, we didn't. The brokers did it.
Okay.
And the brokers did it. And then the managers informally committed to doing a certain amount of business with the brokers. And then the brokers paid us. And actually, that is the way it had to be legally.
Yeah. And so the soft dollar compensation for research, you started to feel that that wasn't the most consistent and lucrative side. And you had gotten a look at the way a lot of the business had operated. You mentioned you had worked with, you were doing these services for some hedge funds as well. Over the years, you and I have talked about it a lot. Are you able to say on the podcast who some of those hedge funds were?
Well, I'm not in business anymore, so I can say
you can anything. Say whatever you want.
Beauty of this interview, right? I can say anything.
So you can say that you used to provide research for soft dollars to the now owner of the New York Mets?
Well, pretty much. We had, at that point, it wasn't SAC Advisors or .78. It was Stevie Cohen, who had an upstairs trading firm at Grunthal.
Yeah.
And I used to go up there and watch them toss a football around in their U-shaped trading room and knock them dead. They were very good.
Oh, yeah.
We had George Soros was a client, and a bunch of people on this sort of famous level. But I wouldn't say that they achieved their results completely relying on Miller Howard's technical scan at all.
Yeah.
We were, a part of their research for sure. It was funny. That was a funny business. It's just a little side note here. I can remember. Do you remember that firm, First American?
Oh yeah.
I don't know if they're even around anymore, but I remember talking to the woman at First American and telling her all about it, and we were able to show it graphically on computer screens and all that sort of stuff. And she was a little bit lukewarm, and then we had been working with one particular broker who was helping introduce us to this kind of investor, and he said, the strange thing here is that it's soft dollars. It's not really their money. And they'd be happier if you charged them more because they would feel like they were getting something really much better and exclusive. So so I 10X'd our fee, and she said, yeah, that's great. I'll do it. That's kind of the innards of the business went at the time. I don't think it's really quite like that anymore, but it was.
So you became an exclusive big player by increasing your fee. Then you get into the world of asset management where you no longer had the pricing power.
Well, not necessary because the scale was so much bigger and better.
Sure. What was the transition like from the Miller Howard you started as that you just described to the Miller Howard I ended up getting to know? How did you become an asset manager?
One of these clients of ours was a Fortune 500 corporation, and they had some internal pension fund money that they were trying to manage, and they were using us in the same way as a kind of a timeliness input. But honestly, let's say this company was located in the Mid-South or the South. And for me, as a kind of a cosmopolitan coastal guy, I thought they were kind of slow. They didn't really get what was happening. Mm-hmm. It was a young company, at youngish compared to other Fortune 500 companies. And they had a ton of money streaming into their pension plan, which was a defined benefit plan. So they needed to manage it better. And they had outside consultants and all of that. But they asked all of their managers and research people to suggest to them how they could manage it better. And I, having a little extra time on my hands compared to the other people there, I thought about it for a while. And I thought, the whole market is just really too much information for a single manager to deal with. Even a large management firm. This is like too much information if you're supposed to know about high-tech companies, how can you also know what the situation with coal shipments? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's too broad. So you really need to, instead of having somebody try to manage the whole ranch, you've got to divide it up into 40-acre plots, actually 10 40-acre plots, the 10 sectors of the S&P 500, and let the managers specialize. Now, they liked the idea. And at the time, the cleverest managers, not necessarily the best, but the cleverest managers chose the largest sectors to manage, right? And so since we didn't have really direct management experience, I chose, and I as I've circled to circle back, I had done a lot of research already in utilities because I thought, well, that's great. That's the most stable kind of sector, and maybe there's a way to find some gold nuggets in the river of utilities. So I had already studied it quite a bit. So I signed up. I signed us up for utilities, which wasn't the largest sector, but at least it got us a start managing. And then I spent a lot of time learning more and more about utilities because I wanted to be good at it. And what I found was that utilities are regulated. They don't have a tremendous opportunity to grow as companies, but some do. And if you could find the utilities that had really solid operating areas, and they had congenial regulation that would help them, you know, if they needed to build something, give them a return on their capital and everything, and they also had some extra reason why they could grow better than the other utilities, they in fact would do better. And it turned out that all utilities pretty much have dividends. They all have yields. But the ones that were able to increase their dividends were some significant outperformers. And this kind of turned on the light a little bit for me.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right. And so, I started thinking, well, does this principle apply across the market?
Well, you mentioned the regulation. Utilities were regulated in terms of what they could charge customers to some degree. Was there regulation on a requirement for them to pay out a dividend?
There never was, but it supported the equity. Yeah. The regulation framework had almost all utilities in rough terms capitalized at 50% debt and 50% equity. So in order to kind of keep that into balance, one of the things that they did was they paid dividends.
Yeah.
And so there was like, I wouldn't say an easy area to manage, but it was a comprehensible area to manage if you didn't have a ton of experience or a business degree. And I started thinking, you know, does this principle expand? And right at that time, an old couple from our area who had a lot of money, they were like the millionaire next door type of couple. He had a contracting business and saved his money. Came to us having read an article on our utilities management, or maybe they saw me on Wall Street Week. I did an appearance on Wall Street Week, which I'll just say, I don't look back with pride on too much because none of it is all that important. But everything I mentioned at Wall Street Week did become a takeover. So that was kind of part of the story, is that there was a lot of consolidation going on in the utility industry. And it wasn't that hard to figure out the formulas that they were using and take positions in the stocks that were likely to be taken over. So we had a lot of that too. But anyhow, these people came in and they showed me their portfolio. And what I saw there was blue chips, Merck, GE, Johnson & Johnson, AT&T. But the current yield on these portfolios, on these stocks, was like 50%, 80%, 40%. That's because they bought them in the 50s. They bought them long ago. They just held them. And the dividends went up over the years so that the yield on original investment was astronomical. In fact, so high that if you held on long enough, you would never have to worry about whether the stocks went up or down or the market went up or down, because you would have an annual income from dividends alone that would far surpass what you could expect from the total return of the S&P 500.
Sure.
Pretty simple. I mean, it's just really down to earth.
And so it sounds like it was two things that happened in this experience. It was you seeing this methodology as a sensible way to manage the utility sector that you had kind of taken some ownership of, but then visually seeing it applied in other sectors, the same concept of dividend growth math applied to blue chip companies in a multi-sector basis.
You could say it that way, sure. And at the same time, I was reading like every academic study out there. I was studying my Ibbotson. I understood very clearly the difference between total return and principal return and income return. You know, I don't think that the academic professors had too much to offer because they weren't, you know, in the battle. But they did have objectivity to offer, and they did have access to the big databases. So there were a lot of informational inputs in addition to this very clear case of this couple. You know, sometimes even as much data as you have and as much history as you have is not as powerful as a single story that says it all. It's inductive reasoning as opposed to deductive, but you know, I like to use both. And so this really, you know, kind of set me going and set me understanding that holding the right thing is better than trading the wrong thing.
And so the experience of doing this with your now company, Miller Howard, in the utility sector, and learning from and seeing the experience of what an institutional investor had from solid companies that had held on long enough to have a yield on cost that became anywhere from 50 to 100% just by reinvesting dividends over time and allowing that compounding to take place. What was the transition from this intellectual awakening to a business model? What made you want to run money doing this on behalf of others as an intermediary?
To the business, well, you know, we had this sort of key client, the corporation that I mentioned.
Yeah.
And they appreciated what we did for them in terms of advisory on structuring their entire pension fund. They appreciated what we did for them in terms of our outperformance with utilities. And so I went to them, I said, look, you know, I've started to study this and we're going to spread out into other conservative companies, companies that you well understand, that also have this reliable dividend plus dividend growth model associated with them. And so they said, okay, you can have two more accounts. So we kept kind of expanding into other sectors that, you know, could sensibly replicate the model. And then we started looking at additional sectors, which let's say are more free market. I mean, the other sectors were like regional banks, REITs, eventually MLPs, basically anywhere where you could count on the cash flow to support the dividend, and you could count on some kind of growth to layer on top of that reliable cash flow. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of others, and none of them have as little risk to the cash flow. For example, business services companies or pharmaceuticals, or the cash flow is not as reliable as the smaller, more conservative companies, but it's still, compared to the rest of the world, it's still kind of really solid. And so we started looking for and studying the universe of companies that had that quality, basically reliable income with a growth in the business, they call it a kicker, but with a growth element on top of it. And of course, the growth element is always a little bit speculative, but after a while, you get experienced. If you've looked at enough companies and had enough ups and downs, you get a little bit of experience and you understand which of the growth elements are more speculative and which are more predictable.
And were you doing this now in the advent of the bond bull market, where yields dropping in the bond market, or were they still really high?
They were going up. They were going up.
So this wasn't in the mid 80s or anything. This was still late 70s, early 80s.
We started the first utility portfolio in 91. So rates were still going up. As you may recall, the cause of the tech bubble crash in 2021 was 2000 and 2001. Yeah. I'm skipping ahead here, aren't I? The proximate cause was increase in rates.
Yeah. So you were, I was off a decade. You're into the early 90s, and now Greenspan's Fed chair. But you have to think about valuations relative to the bond market, but you're really thinking about stock opportunity relative to other stock opportunity.
Well, you have to think about both. We used to get a lot of questions about, well, what happens if interest rates go up? Well, first of all, it's always contextual. Second of all, if you use a dividend discount model, the interest rates are fundamentally balanced by dividends, and actually, in theory, the stocks with no dividends are more sensitive to changes in interest rates than stocks with high dividends, even though the stocks with high dividends are often compared to bonds. And of course, we saw that in spades in the tech bubble crash. Those were the stocks that were hurt the worst by the increase in rates.
And the reason is because they were dependent on a PE ratio that was now very volatile.
PE ratio, and also it's pretty standard in the institutional world to use some kind of a dividend discount model or similar, where there's a multiplier effect on what interest rates are, which is offset to some extent by dividends, but not if they don't pay dividends.
That's right. Oh, and so you become kind of multi-sector, and at what point do you start raising money from outside institutions to become a dividend equity, dividend growth portfolio manager?
That's kind of an interesting sort of business entrepreneur type story. You know, when we were still a research firm, this is transitional, so we were doing some research and then started really seriously managing in 91. We would travel all over the country visiting advisor and broker/advisor offices. You know, we would be going to Morgan Stanley and UBS and all over the country. And these things are melded together, which is why I'm hesitating. So anyhow, we would go to see these broker and advisor offices, and in the same cities there would be an institution that we would try to see at the same time. Or back when we were doing more research, we would go to an institution and we would see a brokerage office. Why? Because they were all in the same building. Everywhere you went, they were all in the same building. So by and by, we went back to those same buildings and began to talk to advisors. And at that time, the financial services industry was sort of restructuring itself to become more advisory rather and less transactional. And they were looking for managers that they could, where they could situate their clients. And a conservative equity manager kind of fit the bill with a lot of advisory firms. It was a struggle because they operated on strong CYA principles. So a place like Morgan Stanley, we had to go back to and back to and back to for years. But we never really got approved for their platform until some advisors, maybe you were one of them, or people like you were one of them, until some advisors started hounding their manager due diligence people and said, look, you got to get these people on the platform. So it happened because we saw it was there, and because we made personal relationships and we were honest, and we made personal relationships with the advisors who needed our services for their clients is kind of how that happened. So we saw what was happening. We didn't try to exploit it. We sort of laid out what it is we do and how it could work for them. And the people that we had visiting advisors also were not really salesmen. They were helpers. They would do everything they could to help an advisor succeed with their business, whether it included us or not.
Well, and in a lot of ways, that consultative approach of those folks is one of the reasons that you and I ended up meeting and working together, because I think you're right that the gentleman who covered me at Morgan Stanley from your firm was consultative. He and I remain friends to this day. and it wasn't a sales relationship at all. It was very consultative, value added, a lot of resources, a lot of education, a lot of just conversation. I'm curious from a timeline standpoint, was it after .com had blown up that a lot of your distribution expanded on Wall Street? Some of these firms, were they looking for a conservative equity manager like you because of the tech implosion?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a softball comment right there. Absolutely. Because people, you know, if you recall, during the late 90s, the average investor was expecting returns of 25 or 30% a year.
Without margin.
Yeah, they thought that was not too greedy. And so when everything imploded, people realized, well, okay, I still have money, a little, less than I did, and the market is still there, companies are still there. I want my investments to be in something real.
So then you get a kind of a value bias, something real, and you had a philosophy. Now you have experience, and you build out a firm that's able to manage money on behalf of others. And that's what Miller Howard Investments really becomes. And of course, we've mentioned you were being distributed through all of these big Wall Street firms, but the one that I was at was Morgan Stanley. That was one of the firms in which you were an approved manager, and we begin our relationship. By the time I meet you, Lowell, you're not just a technical analysis guy who ran a utility portfolio and learned a little tricky math about dividends. You've now become one of the leading dividend growth intellectuals in the industry. Now, that isn't a very big scope of people because we were living through an era in which the types of stuff that guys like I do now and what you were doing then, and there's a few others of us out there. I had another portfolio manager on the podcast a month or so ago, Daniel Paris, who runs the dividend growth portfolio at Federated and had a PhD in Soviet history. You know, this wasn't a real Wall Street hedge fund type of approach. It was very countercultural, which is one of the things that attracted me to it. But you really became an evangelist for this space. I'm wondering if that was driven by you presenting your point of view as a means of growing your own firm, or did you feel a responsibility to grow this entire space, this entire way of thinking about investing? What was kind of going through your head at that time?
You know, there was no patriotism involved. I feel, you know, one of the things, if I could just step back for a minute, one of the things that I noticed in the tech bubble among my friends, very few of whom are in financial industry, one of the things I noticed that First, they would stop looking at their monthly statements, right? And then they would get really mad at their brokers, and they had a feeling that if they had money, they were entitled to make money, right, in the markets. If they had an investment, they were entitled to get a return on their investment, not a 40% loss, yeah. You know, from the Qs, and. So, you know, I feel like investors need guidance and need people to help them invest because that's what they're going to do. But listen, there's a lot of causes and people in this world that, you know, you could have the feeling you wanted to stand up for them other than the investor class, I would say.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's true. I guess someone like me, and sort of the purpose of this podcast is, I would argue, not only that investors are people too, but also that I don't think there's such thing as investment unless it is capital deployed for the purpose of producing goods and services that meet the needs of humanity. So these other causes that might animate us a little more morally, at the end of the day, it's all enhanced experience for humanity. And I don't want to live in a world that doesn't have investment driving that.
Well, no, that's all fine, and that's I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. But I just, you know, I'm not very attached to like social concepts generally.
But you weren't a moral crusader for dividend growth. You believed in it, and you were doing it, and you were writing about it because you did it at your firm.
I knew that this made sense for people, for many people. I knew that it was a way that they could invest and not get hurt. And the reason we got bigger was it was something it filled a need, really. Yeah. And we were, I think, very careful not to exploit that need, but just to serve that need completely. And I think that's a kind of a good entrepreneurial policy.
Yeah.
I think you probably know this, but I'll just say it. We started in business with no assets under management and no track record. And before I left, at peak, we were $9 billion under management. Mm. And we did that from a hilltop in Woodstock, New York.
And you cannot, for those who don't have a reference point for this, or they hear numbers like BlackRock having trillions of dollars in ETFs, that's not what he's referring to. He's talking about bottom up without a huge, massive, you know, BlackRock has hundreds upon hundreds of marketers and salespeople, and they're doing almost free ETFs. He's talking about active management built from a hilltop in Woodstock, very organic growth, and doing so really kind of bootstrapped and organic, and so building this really successful boutique investment manager. Well, I'm going to ask you a question that I've never asked you. What do you think was a bigger headwind? What was a bigger factor in managing dividend growth after the financial crisis up to the point at which you retired roughly a decade later? On one hand, bond yields were collapsing. We went to the zero bound. The Fed went to and held a policy of zero interest rates combined with trillions of dollars of quantitative easing. So you would think dividend growth benefits from having a growing yield at a time that fixed income has no yield. But then on the other hand, FANG, social media, the cloud, low capital intensity technology companies take off. Do you feel like there was a bit of tug of war between the opportunity of high quality dividends versus the competition of what seemed like a kind of new tech boom, a growth boom?
Well, you know, you kind of land here on one of the key problems of investing and the key problems of prediction of anything, which is you don't know what's going to happen, right? So you're right. The context for dividends and dividend growth stocks during that period could hardly have been better. And yet, the glamour and sex appeal of new technology, and I would never say that I'm immune to it either, the glamour and sex appeal of new technology, and I would say even beyond that, the tremendous scale of customers and revenues that these companies were able to generate in half a decade, or a decade at most, the tremendous scale that they were able to generate kind of cast business into a new light in a way. I mean, you know, when you talk about, you know, users and Google and Meta and Amazon, worldwide, you're talking billions of users. And, you know, my model for a dividend growth stock is like local liquor store who like everybody needs and has got steady cash flow and very down to earth, you can count on your fingers sort of a model. So really, billions of customers for a business was an irresistible siren song for investors.
But even in your world, Lowell, you did a you're right, local liquor store model, and in public equities, you know, utilities were usually more regional. But the consumer staples that were great dividend growers, that, you know, weren't there billions of people buying toilet paper and diapers from Procter Gamble and soda pop from Coke and Pepsi and things like that?
Well, that's true. I don't know about billions, but there were a lot of people worldwide on these products. But I don't think this ever happened with the speed and scale that with technology. And also, all those companies had COGS.
Yeah.
For listeners, the cost of goods sold.
Yeah.
Which, like, you know, you join Facebook and Meta doesn't have an additional cost on you, but they can add you to the user base when they charge for advertising.
Yeah. So that scale became very different in what cash flow based businesses were competing with, and therefore a dividend growth manager.
Yeah, those businesses had tremendous return on invested capital.
Yeah.
And they didn't need that much of it to generate generate the same amount of revenues.
Now, did you have a focus on this so-called subject of capital intensity? Right now, we look at some of the great dividend growers in the energy sector, the industrial sector, to some degree, utilities, materials. There's some great dividend growth names there. They have a higher capital intensity. And then there's other businesses that are not great dividend growers but have a low capital intensity. Was that something you thought about, or did you accept high capital intensity in REITs and energy as a necessary part of getting that dividend growth?
Oh, absolutely accepted it, because, you know, what it does is, these companies own assets, and almost by definition, that's a barrier to competition. And any barrier to competition from an investment standpoint is a good thing. I don't mean government barriers to competition, but I mean defense against competition. So, you know, there are, you just have to accept that there are companies that require a lot of capital to generate revenues, but that's, you know, that's kind of the terms of doing business in those areas. It's not like they can have a competitor come in and do the same thing with no capital. It doesn't work that way. I mean, there's different areas to invest in, and an area that has really started to get overlooked in the last 10 years is this very area of companies that make significant investments that have access to capital. You can't make these investments if you don't have access to capital, that have the access and are able to convert their investments into good returns on invested capital. I would say also, you know, looking back now with a little distance to the markets and to everything I thought before, I would have had a stronger, sort of, it's responsive to your question too, I would have had an even stronger emphasis on return on invested capital than I did at the time. We always looked at it, but I would say it's a kind of a really key metric. I would elevate it to the status of a factor. And what's kind of really important, and I guess I and we intuited this at the time, but didn't really articulate it, is among the things that dividends show is that, A, of course, the company has money to pay you, right? But kind of falling out from that is the company is generally going to be a higher quality company. And the higher quality company and a high return on invested capital pretty much go hand in hand. And so one of the things that dividends and dividend growth does for you is it directs you to higher quality companies. And I, at this point, having, you know, sort of been through an adventure and reviewed it, seen it from 20,000 feet, I really understand the sort of eternal verity of investing in quality. And dividends are one of the ways to, one of the arrows that point you in the direction of quality. And dividend growth is like a second arrow that points you in the direction of quality. And then from there, you need to analyze the individual situation and the individual circumstances, see how sustainable it is, evaluate what the chances for growth are, et cetera, et cetera. So it's good that you brought this up and that it came sort of at the end of everything, because ROIC is where it's at really for almost any stock. The one problem with dividend stocks is investors have to be have to know a lot about the companies, and they have to understand businesses and balance sheets and income statements, because some companies have exploited the interest of investors in dividends and sort of jimmied up their dividends,
yeah,
or sustained them longer than they were sustainable,
yeah,
or sort of kind of disguise themselves as dividend and dividend growth stocks. Some companies have done that.
Yeah, but I don't know that that's unique to dividend stocks, because in the era of stock buybacks, if one were to isolate who has taken on more debt as a means of then affecting a capital return, I think a lot more companies added to bond debt for the purposes of buying back stock than added to bond debt for the purpose of paying a fake dividend.
Yeah, that's not necessarily a credit to them.
No, what I'm saying is that it's not unique. It requires an understanding of free cash flow, like you said, balance sheet and income statement. But people can jimmy rig things all kinds of ways if no one's paying attention.
There's good historical statistics on buybacks, and especially on buybacks added to dividends and dividend growth. There's very good historical statistics, but those are historical statistics, and the correlations have changed.
Yeah.
And the correlations have changed when investment bankers and brokers and corporations sort of got wiser and wiser as technology has grown, and they've understood more and more, and they understand that, you know, the market will pop on the day a buyback is announced. And, this kind of whole game is a battle between investor assets and executive compensation. And they want that stock to go up, so they're doing buybacks all that they can. I have never seen a dollar in my pocket from a stock buyback point to. So, they call it return of capital. And you sit there with, like, your lower jaw hung open. Yeah, return of capital. Nobody returned any capital to me.
Yeah. Funny thing about return of capital, you know it when you see it.
Yeah, yeah. You know it when you can spend it. Right. Yeah.
Well, it seems so simple, but it's so profound. And those are the sort of simple profundities that brought you into my orbit to begin with. And
I'm just a simple guy.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot more to it, but I'm so grateful. There's so much more we could unpack here. I think, Lowell, that the journey is fascinating. I hope listeners have found it as fascinating as I do. I'm sure they have. And just to end up into a place in which you build this very successful multi-billion-dollar asset management firm that has a definable philosophy that is not rooted in flavor of the month investing, and that's what I mean by countercultural. I don't think people out there who are not in our business, your former business and my current business, understand how easy it is to raise money if you're willing to tell people whatever they want to hear.
Yeah.
But the refusal to tell people what they want to hear and instead tell them what you really believe, that makes asset gathering harder. It makes sleeping at night better. I think it makes long-term success much better. And I think it's the story of your professional life, and one that you played a huge role in my own. And I'm grateful for it and want to publicly thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm not glad that we helped out everybody in the financial services industry, but I am glad that we helped out you and had a relationship with you, and a relationship that was never just transactional. Of course, we had transactions, but never just transactional. Always went beyond the sort of narrow scope of a particular economic situation. And that's, you have to be a person. You have to live while you're doing these things.
Well, someone should start a podcast talking about economics as the study of human action. That's certainly our belief system, yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, and I will let you get back to it. I hope, I know we'll continue staying in touch. grateful for you and your mentorship and your wisdom. And thank you for taking the time to come talk to the listeners here at Capitol Record.
Really good to talk to you, and good luck to you and all your people.
Thanks so much, Lowell. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. And I do hope that these conversations with my own mentors are providing some insights for you that are valuable. That's why I'm doing Mentor Month. It's, I guess, fun for me. And it's meant to be kind of biographical and a little bit of just sort of projection. But I also just think there's such insights and wisdom from Nick and Larry and Lowell that were worth sharing. And particularly in all three cases, pertinent to the underlying philosophy that drove this podcast, what drives so much what I believe in and what I do. And as you heard me and Lowell talking at the end there, I think that the endeavors that I believe in around of what is real and substantive in dividend growth investing reflect a bigger view of reality. That investing out of speculation is no better than forming public policy out of speculation or anything else. So there is a reality that I believe in. There's a truth I believe in. And I think dividend growth is a manifestation of that in the investment space. And Lowell's ability over the years to provide a kind of research framework and the pillars and tenets of how to think about what dividend growth investing is really just was a huge influence on me, and it has a lot to do with what I believe about capital markets, what we believe about generating an outcome for clients in the real world, and that's why this conversation with Lowell has meant so much to me, and it's why capital markets mean so much to me. They are an instrument, and one could even say they're merely an instrument, but they're a mere instrument to a really important end. And to that end, we work. Thanks so much for listening to National Review's Capitol Record. Look forward to coming back to you next week with Greg Bahnsen on the subject of work.